Coming up on Boston Public Radio, The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick joins us from D.C. to talk about the latest failed attempt to extend unemployment. We'll also find out if the president has plans to rein in the NSA's snooping. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory on still no cameras in the Tsarnaev courtroom, and whether Dan Shaughnessy saying the Pats will lose Sunday in Denver costs the paper readers. Then the head of the Connor Center for Women's Health at the Brigham will talk buffer zones and health inequities beyond reproductive rights.
Open mic with Peter Kazis on the new season of HBO's Girls and Marty Walsh's Therapeutic Politics. Then, are gap years between high school and college good ideas or not? Joyce Maynard, novelist and famed former lover of J.D. Salinger, joins us to detail the new movie based on her book Labor Day and her life beyond Mr. Catcher in the Rye. All that up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Jim.
Spring continues. So efforts to extend long-term unemployment, you probably know, were seriously jeopardized yesterday. The entire effort to reach a consensus on the legislation was undone by the usual partisan bickering. But partisan politics apparently were not in play earlier this week when Republicans and Democrats unveiled a $1 trillion-plus spending deal. Joining us on the line to go over these headlines and a bunch of others from the news is from the Beltway is Todd Zwillick. Todd, as you know, is the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Hey, Todd.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Excellent.
Very
thank
well.
You.
Thanks for joining us, Todd.
Of course.
Much to the upset of people that are without their unemployment benefits, two votes failed. We have no extension of benefits, even for 3 months. And there's not going to be a reconsideration of this until the end of the month. So is this ever going to get fixed, or maybe people are not going to have their benefits restored?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell at this point because the negotiations are such a mess. There are some incentives in place to suggest that there's motivation to get people their benefits. Meanwhile, as I think you mentioned, every week that goes by now since December 28th, another 70,000 people or so have their benefits expiring. And these are people, short-term people out of work. These are, in general, middle-class to lower-middle-class working people who've lost their paycheck because of the economy. They're out of work. Not fired, but laid off or lost their job through some other means, and they get unemployment insurance. Now, it's a very complicated formula that calculates how much you get depending on your income, what state you live in, what the unemployment rate is. But the bottom line is there's about 1.4 million people now who had their checks ending, and these are not people who. There's a myth out there that a lot of these people have been on unemployment for 99 weeks or a year and a half. It's just not the case. The law does not allow that. The average for the people who've lost their checks is somewhere right around 25 to 30 weeks, and that's the amount of time. 31 weeks is the average, I think, to get a new job in this economy. So what happened? I mean, ever since the Bush administration, Congress has been extending unemployment benefits. They've had some debates about whether to pay for it with cuts elsewhere. Usually they don't pay for it because they consider it emergency spending. So that debate is out there again, and that's not a surprise because that's sort of a rehash. But they usually get deals on this kind of stuff, and this time they didn't. There's some procedural, I guess you could call it bickering, some fallout from the Harry Reid nuclear option move.
Right.
With presidential appointees, a lot of Republicans are upset about that, and they're arguing over the number of amendments. But look, this is really about budget agreements and really about incentives. We can't crawl inside the heads of any individual member of Congress, but we can sort of look at what their incentives are here and why maybe they haven't gotten a deal yet. Lots and lots of Democrats want this solved because they believe in unemployment insurance. They consider it stimulative because these folks are not banking the money or investing it with Goldman Sachs. They're spending it. They're spending it to pay the bills and to buy the groceries, and that's stimulative. Democrats will walk around here and pull you aside and say, too many of these Republicans, they talk a good game, but they don't want to do anything stimulative. They don't want to do anything that helps really bring the economy out of a morass because it makes Obama look bad. Okay, maybe. We're just talking incentives here. We're not casting blame on anyone. Democrats want you to believe that. Republicans want you to believe that there is a new – election year rhetorical strategy coming from the White House and Democrats that's all about the middle class, that's all about inequality, that's all about wages and the minimum wage and a fair deal and student loan prices and health care. And they want you to think that Harry Reid doesn't really want the policy. Harry Reid wants the issue. He wants to lord this over Republicans. And it, yes, they may solve it, but they don't want to solve it before the State of the Union address so that President Obama can use it as a little bit of a dagger during that, you know, those rare primetime presidential speeches when the public is actually watching.
But he is going to use it as a dagger. See, I operate under the assumption, you're kinder than I, Todd, that virtually nothing is beyond strategic. Meaning, I know that some members of Congress actually believe in things, but that old line, the only thing they stand for is re-election. This Congress is so pathetic. When you mentioned 70,000, I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We have 104,000 people or something. That's virtually the size of my hometown. I mean, it is just, it is staggering, and it's such short money. We talked last week about, my view is why you should extend it regardless. If you got to figure out a way for it to pay for it, and it's a Republican way, you got to do it because it's such an extreme kind of thing. But I guess where Marjorie was going is when they come back at the end of the month, is there any reason to think they're going to do better in terms of fixing this than they were able to do in December and mid-January?
There are a couple of signs for optimism, Jim. First of all, there was legitimate negotiation between the parties on this. I don't want you to think they were in their corners with their arms folded. Yeah. You know, not negotiating. They were actually negotiating. There was a fairly large group of Republicans who were negotiating with Harry Reid, who were trying to get a bipartisan deal. It was never really, really close to being consummated. Harry Reid was willing to do it, took it back to Democrats, and some senior Democrats rejected the deal on some budgetary grounds. Look, Republicans are also trying to tack on to this, giving some money back to military veterans, money that was cut in the Ryan-Murray budget deal of late last year. See how everything's connected? It's like an ecosystem around here. It really is. I don't want to get too hokey.
I would say everything is disconnected, but I understand your point.
Well, be like the David Attenborough of Congress here. But everything really is connected. And so they're trying to plug money that was taken away by Murray and Ryan, and they want it to be on UI. And Democrats don't want that because the budget deal was so hard, and you're undoing the budget deal that we agreed to, and then sequestration's part of it. So, but there is reason for optimism because there are Republicans who have motivation to fix this. Dean Heller of Nevada is one of them. He's a conservative Republican.
He's the co-sponsor with Jack Reed from Rhode Island, the underlying thing to begin with, right?
That's right. Of one of the deals that failed, there were several iterations that didn't get off the ground here, didn't get 60 votes. You needed 60 because Republicans were blocking this, let's be clear. Dean Heller's one of them. He's a conservative Republican, but he's in a state with the worst unemployment in the country.
Right,
he's 49 and Jack Reed is 50.
That's
so
exactly right.
Yeah. So, you know, but, you know, as Democrats are fond of saying, not to echo their turns of phrase, but, you know, the unemployed live in red states, too. So there is incentive to get something done. They have been talking. There was an offer for amendments on both sides. And while that sounds arcane, that's something that doesn't happen much around the Senate anymore because it's so divided and partisan that they don't actually vote on amendments because they're too afraid of partisan weapons. So there's some reason for optimism.
Well, there is another small reason for optimism here. We're going to ask Todd Zwillick, the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, about this right now. Actually, this $1.1 trillion funding bill that they unveiled on Monday that would ease some of the sequester cuts and give some new money to things like the early childhood education. That's a little bit of hope, isn't it? Because people expect this is, you know, it's a bipartisan deal. People expect it's actually going to get support in both parties, in the House and in the Senate. So that's a little bit of hope, isn't it?
Short answer, yes with a but.
We're looking
and here
for
it comes.
Crumbs from the table, Todd Zwillick. It's rather pathetic.
Well, none of it was a surprise. This is just the check writing that is the iteration of that Ryan Murray budget deal. Ryan and Murray agreed to little less than $1.1 trillion back when they made that deal. Then they send that to the appropriators and they say, okay, guys, there's your top line, $1.1 trillion, figure it out. So we already knew that this deal was coming, and now we get the details on who the winners and the losers are. Is it a good thing? Yeah, I mean, low bar, Marjorie. You know what it means? It means no government shutdown next September. And so then you have another year after that. However, I got to tell you, there still is no – this budget agreement between Ryan and Murray is not what they call regular order. It's not the budget committees in the House and Senate agreeing on a budget. That doesn't exist. It probably won't exist next year. We're still under sequestration. We're still in a, you know, pretty sluggish economy where revenues aren't doing what they should be. So, you know, does it portend bluebirds and cooperation on the budget? I wouldn't bet a dollar on that. I just wouldn't. Now, it does mean no shutdown threats for the next year and a half. So that's good. But that's the bar that we're at now. Hey, they're not going to burn the house down for the next 18 months. And that's really all this deal means for now. That is really literally all it means
for now. Okay. So clearly I was optimistic over nothing. Todd, is what you're basically telling me here. I got my hopes up.
Not nothing, but not as much as you thought.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay. Enough with inter-party squabbling. Let's talk about intra-party squabbling. We want to get into what the Republican reaction, potential presidential candidate reaction in Washington has been to the travails of Chris Christie. Now, the reason we're asking is not really because we're interested in your opinion, Todd. The reason we're asking is we wanted an opportunity to play something from Jimmy Fallon's show last night. His only guest was Bruce Springsteen. The two of them did a version of Born to Run that was influenced by the George Washington Bridge debacle. Listen.
Wall Street master stuck cheek to cheek with blue-collar truckers. And man, I really gotta take a leak. But I can't. I'm stuck in Governor Chris Christie's fault. Little Jersey traffic jam.
Okay, we got that out of the way last night. Jimmy Fallon, again, pretty good, don't you think? Now,
yeah, and when I saw the clip this morning, it made me wince because, man, doesn't everybody in New Jersey and beyond just court the boss for his kind of, you know, he's the American Bono. You just want his blessing. And for the governor of New Jersey to have Bruce Springsteen turn on him, I mean, I know we're goofing around, but it does hurt.
Well,
it
do you remember the great photo, though? Because Christie is apparently going to hundreds of Springsteen
exactly.
concerts last year. There's a picture of him in the front row fast asleep at a Springsteen. So I guess what's good for the goose. But the issue is when I'm reading quotes from Republican leaders, some who will be running for president, some who have candidates other than Chris Christie, for example, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who are virtually inseparable. Obviously, people know McCain, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. While McCain said, I thought he did a good job, and I'm paraphrasing, at the press conference a week ago, Lindsey Graham said things like, well, it sort of reinforces the notion of him engaging in bully-like behavior. Are other Republicans salivating over the troubles of Chris Christie in Jersey?
A couple of them are, and the ones that are salivating are his enemies on the right. I'll give you Rand Paul as an example, who's been taking sort of passive-aggressive swings at Chris Christie most of the week. And look, those two were going at it before. Surprisingly little reaction from Republicans. Actually, there's a couple of reasons for that. One, it's very, very early. Everybody, look, in politics, keep your powder dry until you absolutely have to load it up. So you don't want to say too much because maybe Chris Christie will come out of this being the big champion and everybody else will look stupid. Or if you defend him, maybe he was lying the whole time and he'll go down in a ball of flames. So keep your powder dry as part of it. But also, Chris Christie is touted. Chris Christie has a big media following. Let's break down sort of what's going on in Republican land right now. The Republican Party, as we know, is extremely divided. Chris Christie is a bit of a media darling the way McCain was in 2004. He's a plain talker. He's bipartisan. The political professional journalists and pundits know that if Republicans are going to find somebody who can bridge the couple of wings of the party and have any chance of running in 2016 on a national election, it's probably Christie. That doesn't mean that Republicans want him, however. And the right of the Republican Party, which is resurgent and strong, and the Tea Party and the Freedom Works and the conservatives, we all know who these people are. They hate Christie. They don't like him. He wasn't invited to the conservative to the Value Voters Summit, the Conservative Action Conference. There were Tea Party and Freedom Work activists all over Twitter during the, you know, Bridgegate, whatever you want to call it, just absolutely mocking Chris Christie. And these are Republicans. So the national players and the you know, the big kids in the Republican Party have their powder mostly dry, and then all of the people at the kids' table are you know, tossing cranberry sauce at him.
That's a great way to put it.
It's not even Thanksgiving. I don't know why I went there, but I kind of did.
You know, we wanted to change gears. One last thing, which is a difficult thing to talk about. I don't mean difficult, but it's hard to prognosticate because so few details are public. But the president was given, I believe, 46 recommendations, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, about reforming of the NSA. And then there's a piece in the Washington Post, I think yesterday, that says the outcome is not going to be to, they're speculating, obviously, to reform and rein in the snooping of the NSA. But their great line was, is that Obama's going to institute NSA-style monitoring of NSA employees. The point being, his major goal is to make sure there are no more Edward Snowdens rather than dealing with what concerns a pretty interesting cross-section of America. Do you have any insight at all as to where he's going to end up going with this later this month?
Talking about watching the watchers, which is a cliche.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes. I guarantee we'll get tossed around more before the end of the week. I shall try not to use it except that one time.
You did already, yes.
I just did. Look, there. In Congress, there is a pretty stark divide over this issue. NSA snooping, the 215 program, PRISM, and the other things that we've read about, you have to know, enjoy very, very broad bipartisan support in this Congress. Most of your lawmakers are for it. They're just for it. They've been the ones that have been briefed think that it works. Nobody wants to be responsible or have sponsored the bill to eviscerate some intelligence function 3 weeks before a terrorist attack. So that might give you some idea why. Now, there are exceptions. And Ron Wyden, the ascendant member of the Intelligence Committee, is at odds with Dianne Feinstein, who's the chairman over this. Ron Wyden has been pitching a series of NSA reforms and FISA reforms to the other part of this, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
The secret court. That approves these things, some of these
things. Not so secret anymore, but their proceedings are secret. And, you know, granting basically blanket warrants and all this stuff that has been going on since the Bush administration, all of this stuff has come into light. Are you going to see any real reforms to what matters here is NSA's authorization? What does the law say they may do? And how many loopholes are there that really tighten down the screws on what they may do? I'm not in the business of speculating too much, but knowing how divided the Congress is and how hard the White House is leaning on people, I'm going to doubt there's a great deal of NSA reform on what they can actually do with their authority. Now, FISA sunlight and some reforms to the FISA court, the process, having a public privacy advocate in front of FISA, that's a different story, and that stuff may have a lot more juice.
We only have 1 minute left, Todd, but the one place where I guess I disagree with you, there was a vote in July or June about reining in NSA snooping in the House, and the reason it got a lot of play here is because every single member of the House delegation from Massachusetts voted for it, except for Joe Kennedy, who voted against it. Had six votes switched, it lost by 12, had six votes switched, essentially NSA would have only been able to do this metadata thing on people it had targeted. So there are some pieces of this where there seems to be this odd liberal Democrat, libertarian Republican axis, isn't there?
There is, and that vote gave a lot of people in the intelligence community pause. And you're totally right. That came within a couple of votes of passing. Here's a couple things to know about it. It was a safe vote. Everybody knew it wasn't going anywhere and that the Senate wouldn't touch it. Yeah. And if you have free rein, hey, vote however you want. You don't have to worry about the law changing. You know, you don't have to worry about changing the law and then having a terrorist attack of somebody they could have been listening to. Boy, is that a politician's worst nightmare. So safe votes are hard to gauge for what they really, really mean. But you are correct to say that vote was close. You are correct to say there are a lot of people, at least rhetorically, who want to rein in the NSA. Part of the question is, do they tinker with NSA's authorization and say you can't spy on these people without a specific authorization? Or do they do it through the FISA court and modify the way the FISA court grants its warrants that would have sort of the same effect through the side door?
Todd Zwillick. Great to talk to you, as always.
Well, wait a second. Don't call us back until you have good news on something, will you, Todd?
I know. I was all excited about the $1.1 trillion, and you totally sucked the wind right out of my sails,
Todd.
But that's okay.
Thanks, Todd Zwillick.
Thanks, Todd.
Guys, anytime.
Todd Zwillick is the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Coming up, our talk, which we do every week with the Boston Globe's editor, Brian McGrory. We're going to talk to him about, stay tuned here. We talked to him about 89.7. WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She would be Marjorie Egan, and he, the guy with us right now, as he is every single Wednesday, is the editor of the Boston Globe. That would be Brian McGrory. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
Very well, Brian McGrory. You know, I got to ask you this. When we used to talk about Sarah Palin on our old radio show, Brian, you know, and criticize her, we'd get pummeled. You know, people, we're never going to listen to your show again, and how can you criticize her?
We're never going to listen to the station again.
That's right. That's right. We were like, you know, voodoo dolls and all that kind of stuff. You got a great quote from Dan Shaughnessy's column on the front page of the paper today. Dan's going to be with us Friday, actually, to talk about the game. But here's what he says. It's the start of his column. The Broncos are going to beat the Patriots Sunday. Sorry, that's just the way I see it. I'm not rooting for the Broncos. I am not into satanic worship. Please do not kill my whole family. So I wonder, do you get that same kind of pummeling? I mean, I'm sure Shaughnessy does in a lot of the comments, but I mean, do you
cancel my subscription?
Exactly.
Look, at Dan revels in this stuff. You guys both know Dan Shaughnessy.
He
loves this stuff, and I love seeing him write things like this. I think he's crazy, crazy for doing it. But the reality is, he is a really smart observer of sports. I mean, I'll be honest. In this town, I don't know of anybody better, and he's in rare company in the country. And he knows football. He knows all sports, and he also loves to poke the fanboys out there, as he calls them. What does he say today? The people in their footy pajamas.
Footy pajama fanboys.
I mean, it's beautiful. So does he hear about it? Oh God, yes.
Oh no. Do you hear? I mean, the point we were trying to make.
No. The point is, if I heard about it, I'd tell him to stop.
Right.
You're an honest man, Brian.
No, it's fine as long as it doesn't count.
Okay. That's very honest.
No, I do hear about it.
He wrote this whole thing before.
Brian's about to. Well, I'm sorry. What are you saying? You do hear about it, but what?
I think people get what Dan does. I think people get the role he plays. And it's a really valuable role here in this city and at this paper.
Brian's laughing at himself, by the way. I want you to know. Are you not laughing at yourself?
There's no bigger fan of me than I was.
Well, you know, part of the reason we wanted to ask you about this is because Dan himself wrote a column a little while ago kind of explaining to people, hey, I'm not here as a chief cheerleader of the New England Patriots or the Boston Red Sox and blah, blah, blah. So clearly there's some people who don't get it, right?
Well, we actually pulled that column out of the sports section and put it on the front
page
because I thought it was as good a description of what a sports columnist does as I have ever read. It was beautifully well done and a great explainer. Look, Dan routinely does this. I mean, he would do this for a minor league preseason game, for God's sakes, predicting the winners and the losers. He loves to call doomsday. He loves to say things are too easy or too hard. It's just what he is. He is a hyperbolic columnist, and he does it better than anybody I know. But the backdrop, as I said before, is he's really, really smart about it.
Yeah.
Hey, Brian, we discussed this with you several times in the last handful of months, but it's arisen again, at least in my mind. So I wanted to get a brief update, if there is one. In the Tsarnaev case, the judge has given the defense additional time to work on their change of venue motion. I don't want to talk about that. What I want to talk about is, once again, we saw none of it. We've discussed this with you. State courts, cameras get everything. Federal courts, cameras get nothing, whether it's Sal DeMacy's trial or the Tsarnaev trial or the Bulger trial. Is anybody talking about this, or do we just get outraged for a day and then we move on until we get outraged again? Nothing's happening on any front, is there?
We have had discussions about this, and we've had relatively recent discussions with members of the federal judiciary. It's I think it's outrageous that the courts are where you go for the last remedy. It's where society goes when nobody else can solve a problem. And the idea that the feds have decided to keep these procedures, kept from the public at large, is just—it's not right. Not in this day and age, and I think it hurts their credibility, and I think they're doing themselves no small amount of harm. So there are discussions that are going on. There has been talk. You and I have talked about this before, Jim, about possible steps and maybe allowing one trial to be broadcast, but that has never come to be here in this district. But we're still very hopeful, and we're still actually pushing.
Well, hey, by the way, just so I'm clear, based on research, one of our colleagues that I mentioned
and
this
I've
before.
And I've written a lot about
this.
Oh,
go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, because I am obsessed with this, too. There has been legislation, actually, if at the federal level, filed, I think, every year or close to every year since 2006, where Congress could change this. And, you know, it's been incredible. I've called every member of our delegation to say, are you going to make people that want to come to the trial who've been severely injured in the Boston Marathon bombing have to come to Boston if they want to watch it? I mean, the political sort of just not caring is a big deal. But our delegation seems not at all interested in trying to open up the courtroom. They could make a push for this, and they could push their other colleagues to push this legislation through. But they don't.
I'm not aware of who stands where on this in our delegation. I do know, or it's my understanding, that the Supreme Court could take action on this tomorrow and allow television cameras to be present at trials, particularly the Tsarnaev trial.
They could, by the way. And the way that works, for those out there who don't know, is they promulgate rules. They got to be approved by Congress. Congress always rubber stamps the court rules. But they do have the power, the final authority, if they chose to use it, as Marjorie said, to change the rules and allow courtrooms either on an experimental basis, a trial basis, or permanently in the courtrooms. But they do not.
My understanding, Jim, is Judge Gertner, now retired, had made a move towards possibly bringing cameras in for, remember the song piracy issue we had?
Oh, sure.
Here?
The kid from BU who was fined hundreds of thousands of dollars for downloading, a couple of dozen songs or something.
That made us all very nervous.
Yeah. And that ended up going nowhere. But something needs to be done there. It's an absurd situation.
So, Brian, we read in the Globe, I think it was last Sunday, the business section, about the Bay State Banner getting a $200,000 loan from the city of Boston when they were going having some difficulties. I mean, it was kind of a weird thing, I thought. I mean, can you imagine the city of Boston bailing out the Herald or the Globe if we were on the skids?
Well, and then the owner paying himself back, according to the Globe, $200,000,
right,
but paying the city back only $1,500. Only making
one payment.
One payment,
so
yeah.
Far.
Yeah.
It was a very well-done story, actually. I mean, Marjorie, to your point, I've always thought that why didn't Pat Purcell or the New York Times Company apply for a slot license and use all of the vacant space that we have in this building to run a slot parlor and keep the journalism afloat by that way?
What's the answer to that question?
That's
it's
a great
idea.
I never got a good answer. I thought I'd get a promotion from it, and I'd try to be a greeter or something like that, but... I mean, look at if the racetracks, you have Plain Ridge was making this pitch, and obviously Suffolk Downs was as well, to try to keep the tracks afloat by bringing in this kind of gaming, slots or table games. Why wouldn't you do that to journalism? I mean, I say this only half kidding, but in terms of a public subsidy for a newspaper, I think we get into very dicey ground there, and we've kind of seen that play out with the Bay State Banner.
I also want to say one thing about the piece, beyond the fact that it was a good piece. One of the critics, I say this to Marjorie all the time, one of the things that drives me nuts about journalism is we follow up on far less than we should. And the fact that that loan, taxpayer money, went out, wasn't repaid, again, while the guy's repaying himself and you guys pursued it, I thought was terrific. Hey, Brian, we know you're careful in your new capacity to not speak terribly ill or well of politicians, and we semi-respect that. So we decided we'd go beyond our borders briefly today so you don't have to worry about it because you don't really cover them except, I guess, at arm's length. Briefly, on Foodgate, which is the cutting of a pizza with a knife and a fork by the new man of the people, mayor of New York City, and on Bridgegate with Chris Christie. Starting on Christie, what's your take on the Christie dilemma?
On that one, first of all, it's the greatest story ever.
Ever.
I mean,
it's up there, yeah.
It is a beautiful, beautiful story. It's one of these rare stories that is so easily understandable by everybody. It goes right to the heart of what Chris Christie portrayed himself to be, and that is this no-nonsense, always tell the truth, completely transparent governor who's never going to pull any shenanigans. And here it is, the ultimate shenanigans, penalizing a guy who's not even a mayor, who's not even a political opponent. You just didn't support him. And bringing an entire town into 4 days of gridlock as a result was just fundamentally beautiful, is a story. I think he's really going to be hurt by this. And now we're seeing other news trickle out about his relationship with the mayor of, what is it, Jersey City?
Yeah. Yes.
I think there's going to be some trouble for him ahead. In terms of de Blasio eating pizza with a knife and fork, let me ask you, Jim, you eat French fries with a knife and fork, don't you?
By the way, you know what, that tradition, I happen to be Jewish, and it's a Jewish tradition, yeah. Just like it's an Italian tradition. No, I do not eat them with a knife and fork, Brian.
Yeah, that's not what we hear from the Capitol Grill, Jim, the times you've been there. I think you were there with Brian on several occasions, too. So, Brian, is there a Boston equivalent? We were trying to think of it. Is it like a politician going out for lobster and wearing a bib, or is there
no,
some
well, that's
sort
an
of...
appropriate thing. You were the one that came you up with the other day, Marty Walsh eating sushi on St. Patrick's
yeah.
Day.
You can't be wearing a
Did
bib.
He? Or are you
no,
just,
I was saying no. That would be a rough equivalent, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Suddenly learning that Marty Walsh's favorite restaurant was L'Espalier or something like that, and he was there for lunch every
That's
day.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
And you would know it's not because you've never bumped into him there. Is that correct?
Clever.
Thank you.
Clever.
I appreciate that very
yeah.
much.
That's a good one. Number 9 Park, right next to the State House there. That's a pretty snazzy place.
Well, Marjorie, they're not open for lunch. You know that.
Oh, excuse.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me, Brian.
I didn't know. Brian McGroy, we only have a short time with you today, so a couple more things we wanted to get in here. Jeff Jacoby's son, Caleb, wonderfully was found unhurt in New York City. What happens now? I mean, is this just from your perspective as the editor, you know, whatever Jeff wants to mention in the paper or not, or what do you do about...
I mean, from my point of view, it is a completely private situation now. We are having nothing to do with that. Jeff knows that we're here to help him with whatever he needs, but, thank God his son was found safe, and we just wish Jeff and his whole family the very best.
As do we. Now, Brian, the good news for you is we only have 2.5 minutes left. The bad news is we have created a new segment for our Brian McGroy discussions. Marjorie named it As the Globe Turns, where we ask you questions about things inside the globe, but all of us are particularly interested. You notice there's silence on the other side of the line. Two things, both serious, by the way. I didn't mean to make light of this. We spoke to you last week on the same day that John Henry gave a widely acclaimed speech at the Boston Chamber of Commerce. We talked to you about that. Later in the day, a 30-year employee of the Globe, obviously the publisher, Chris Mayer, decided to step down. Were you surprised by that?
Well, look, maybe surprised is only part of it. First of all, I was disappointed. Chris Mayer was a phenomenal publisher for the Globe. He had enormous successes over the last 4 years. He led this newspaper back from the very darkest of times, right after the New York Times threatened to shut us down, after the New York Times tried to sell us 4 years ago, 5 years ago. Chris was named publisher. He rebuilt morale in here. He had our backs. He understood the mission of our newsroom inherently. He was a great newspaper publisher, and he also did some very novel things here, including opening up BostonGlobe.com as what is now a very successful subscription website. So disappointed that he is no longer here. But to your question about whether I'm surprised or not, look, this is the real world, and new owners have the right to their own people in charge and people who they're comfortable with and people who, you know, they may want to bring in themselves. So as well as Chris did, John Henry also has the right to his own people, too. So and Chris has the right to work in a job in which, he can really flourish as well. So it's difficult to see Chris leave, but it's just what happens in the real business world here.
And our second and final thing on As the Globe Turns is, speaking of having people, you now have a digital advisor.
Yeah,
we read in the
one.
Herald this morning.
I want one.
What does that mean? I mean that seriously. What is David Skok, who I've Callie Crossley, who's involved in the Neiman program, spoke glowingly of him to us this morning. What does he do for you?
Well, David is coming. He's going to be starting here next week. His title is initially digital advisor to the editor, and really excited to have him. He's a nationally known as just a creative, imaginative, innovative thinker in terms of how we portray the Boston Globe on our different digital platforms, whether they be apps on your smartphone or iPad or on your desktop, and how we can tailor journalism to people who prefer to read us on a screen rather than in print. I mean, that's the way of the world, and I determined very quickly that I needed somebody who knew a whole lot more than I did about this kind of thing, and I couldn't have found anybody better to do it.
Hey, Brian, very quickly, you'll be back from Denver by next Wednesday, so we'll be able to talk to you. Is that correct?
Oh, you know, unless I get caught up out there. What kind of question is that? That's such a trick question. I am going to be watching the game on my couch here in Greater Boston.
Okay,
how's that, Jim? Jim,
okay.
are you going to watch the game?
Yeah, the football. It's a football game, right?
Yeah. There we go.
Thank you. Hey, Brian, it's a pleasure. Take care of yourself.
Brian,
good
thank
to talk
you very
to you.
Much for joining us, as always.
Thank you, Marjorie. Thank you, Jim.
Bye.
Brian McGroy is the editor of the Boston Globe, and he joins us every Wednesday. When we come back, we're going to look at the inequities in healthcare that women still face that go way beyond reproductive rights, which were argued about today before the Supreme Court. That conversation is next with Brigham and Women's Dr. Paula Johnson on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marg Regan. This morning, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a Massachusetts case testing the constitutionality of buffer zones at abortion clinics. By the way, the Associated Press report begins. The Supreme Court seemed likely Wednesday to strike down a Massachusetts law setting a 35-foot protest-free zone outside abortion clinics. The fact that abortions remain such a volatile issue 40 years after Roe v. Wade is a reminder, I think, that when it comes to reproductive rights and more, there are still a lot of inequities when it comes to women in healthcare. Here with us in Studio 3, to go over buffer zones and what progress has been made and how much more work needs to be done is Dr. Paula Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the executive director of the Connors Center for Women's Health at Brigham and Women's Hospital and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Johnson, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for coming in, Dr. Johnson. So since this just happened, and I know you are pro-choice on the board at Planned Parenthood, buffer zones, I think most people think that are involved in reproductive rights are very important. So suppose this happens, the skeptical court gets rid of them. What's the impact?
Well, you know, I think that the impact is a negative one. The buffer zones allow women to get access or have access without obstruction to care that is their legal right. And I think that that's what we need to ensure for all women, quite frankly, for all people in the United States, having unfettered access to health care in a way that allows them to have the highest quality health care is part of what we've been focusing on in our country around the Affordable Care Act and access to insurance and ability to access health care.
Well, you know, one of the things that does drive me crazy about the buffer zone issue is it drives me crazy that 41 years almost, the anniversary of Roe v. Wade is coming up, we are still arguing about buffer zones, that women have to be kind of shipped off to these freestanding clinics, and Planned Parenthood does a great job, and everybody that's pro-choice loves them. But, you know, many people, including myself, think that it would be the unfettered access you talked about would be much easier attained if women could go to their physician's offices, to go to freestanding clinics that treat diabetes and asthma and everything else, or even secure clinics within hospitals. But I suspect hospitals don't want to put up with this hassle, and neither do physicians. And that's why women still have to worry about buffer zones.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that that's true. I would take a very different view on access to women's health and placement of women's health. I think that women's health can occur and should occur in different locations and settings that make various aspects of health care accessible to women, and that can take the shape and form of many different types of sites. And I think it's our role to ensure that women can have that access in different forms. And I would say that healthcare institutions provide services in a way that They provide a full comprehensive range of women's health services and feel very positively about that.
Yeah,
but Dr. Johnson, we had Martha Coakley, the Attorney General, in here the other day, whose case it is. She didn't argue it, but she's there and she brought the case to the Supreme Court. I have to say, even if the 30, and we said this to Martha, to the Attorney General, even if the 35-foot buffer zone is upheld, which it apparently is not, even Elena Kagan, who's part of the liberal wing, formerly of Harvard Law School, said she was, quote, hung up on the issue in the argument
over
this
the
morning.
Over the size of it. She didn't like the size of the zone.
Which is not very comforting. It is still – I drive by, for example, on Commonwealth Ave, the site where there is a 35-foot buffer zone in Boston. It is still a pretty intimidating thing. If a woman is going through what is, I'm assuming, in virtually all cases, a pretty emotional, pretty tough situation, to have people even that close is, to me, a pretty intimidating experience. So why isn't it a better idea? I mean, if Planned Parenthood was, for example – relocated into hospitals, obviously with the permission. Why isn't that a win-win situation? Then we don't have to keep going back to a Supreme Court and hoping that middle-aged men are going to make the right decision about women's reproductive freedom.
I really think, Jim, that this is the wrong question.
What is the right question?
I just think that the question is that there are many different ways, sites, and forms of women's health care. And the question is how to allow women to access health care in very different ways and forms in a way that is safe and allows them choice. And so to me, whether or not we should or shouldn't have Planned Parenthoods is really the wrong question. Many different types of reproductive...
I'm not arguing against Planned Parenthood. Let me be clear.
I
agree
you.
With Margaret on the freestanding
thing.
I
think that many different types of health care institutions, Planned Parenthood included, provide extraordinarily important services and provide important services in a way that are accessible potentially in ways that they may not be if they're located in different settings. So I think the question is not whether they should or shouldn't be freestanding. The question is, this range is critically important for women and women of all ages.
Range of options.
Range of options.
Yeah.
Right.
But hold on. One last thing on this, and then I'll get off it, because this is one of my obsessions. Uh-huh. Right now, there isn't that choice. If you're a woman with not a lot of money and you're probably young, and that's mostly who's getting abortions at clinics like Planned Parenthood or the ones in Brookline, that's your choice. If you're 35 or 40 and you are well insured and you find yourself at the pregnancy you don't want, you can probably go many other places to get that abortion. I just think it's awful that so many young women have to put up with this stuff, because you know what it's like, the screaming, yelling, signs. It's scary. And you have to go through a metal detector. I mean, I guess I don't know why we as women, pro-choice women, put up with this.
Well, you know, part of the reason I'm here today is actually to discuss broader issues of women's health. And I think if we stopped focusing only on abortion as the women's health issue, we might be able to change the dialogue. And there are many broad issues that we need to address.
You know, I don't get shocked terribly often by things I read in the newspaper. I was shocked by the piece you wrote about a week or so ago in the Boston Globe. Every Cell Has a Sex was the title. The subheadline, Research Needs to Recognize Health Differences Between Men and Women. Explain to people what are the facts that your piece was based upon.
So the title, I unfortunately can't take credit for the title. That was a term coined by the Institute of Medicine a bit over 10 years ago when they wrote a report that really identified the fact that every cell does have a sex, that men and women are different down to the fundamental cellular and molecular levels. Women have two X chromosomes, men have an X and a Y. And so that we truly are different with regard to health and disease. And we see that expression of difference in so many areas, whether it be in rates of disease, whether it be in how disease is expressed, for example, heart disease, different symptoms, the way it looks when women and men have blockages in their arteries.
You mentioned women who've never smoked or diagnosed with lung cancer at rates three times that of men.
Yeah.
who are non-smokers.
Or depression. Depression. Yeah. I was stunned. Yeah. Tell people the numbers on depression.
Well,
men versus women.
Women are 70% more likely than men to have depression over their lifetime. And we also know that, you know, at any one time there, you know, women are twice as likely at any given time to have depression compared with men. And there, you know, the changes or the differences are profound across a number of areas, whether it be depression, lung cancer, and non-smoking women who, you know, it's three times more likely than men to experience it, all the way to Alzheimer's. And women are significantly more likely to develop Alzheimer's. And it's not just because we live longer. There are these fundamental differences, sex differences in disease. And we really are only at the tip of the iceberg in understanding what those are.
And so you raised quite, based upon these differences, the part that I was shocked by is you start talking about what clinical research looks at and what it doesn't look at. Start with the latter. What does it not look at in terms of every cell has a sex? Yeah.
So let's go back because it's important to understand the trajectory of women's health research. And in 1993, President Clinton signed a law that was called the NIH Revitalization Act. And what that did was it mandated that women and minorities be included in trials that were funded by the NIH. So before 1993...
How pathetic is that? I was just going to say, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it was very interesting. Before that, there were guidelines at the NIH, but those guidelines, it was found, were not really adhered to. And there were certain flags that then became before advocates and also those who were really looking at these issues in Congress at the time. One was that the big study on aspirin from the Physicians' Health Study had come out, which showed that aspirin was protective against heart attack. And what they realized was that the study very purposely was done in male physicians. It was a great study, but what had gotten what they realized was that this was only done in men. Important study, but only done in men. We've since changed that. But between that happening and then there being this awareness that was raised, a government report was called for. And that report really showed that the guidelines at the NIH were not being followed. And it became pretty clear that legislation was necessary. So this law was signed by President Clinton. People like Barbara Mikulski, Henry Waxman, Olympia Snow, Pat Schroeder were all very involved. So this was a bipartisan effort. And since that time, we have made progress. So women are routinely included. Minorities are routinely included. The problem is that we are still not including women in adequate numbers to actually understand how they do. We still are not analyzing the data. So even if women are included, we're still not analyzing the data so that we understand the impact of whatever we're studying on women. We're still not studying women and men to understand sex differences. So this is kind of before you get to the trial phase. And really interestingly, when you go back and look at animal studies, so these are kind of the rats and the mice, over a number of fields, physiology, you know, et cetera, neuroscience, the majority of studies are either done with male rodents or the sex of the rodents isn't identified. And
terrible.
And let's just think about that because if it's the preclinical studies, right, the studies that are done before the trials that really determine what we bring to trial and how we think about it, if we're not considering those differences in sex early on, you can imagine it could lead us in the wrong directions. So we've come a long way, but there is so much farther to go.
The other thing that I found stunning was the story that talked about how American women, and we'll get to the racial divide in a second too, which is equally stunning, but are dying sooner than women in other first world countries. I sort of stupidly thought that we were going to live the longest, and now I find out I could be keeling over at any second.
Well,
I hope not.
I think, you know, that's not – on that issue, it's not just women. It's men, too. I mean, the United States, although we've got phenomenal resources and in many, many ways a phenomenal healthcare system, we still are not doing as well as we should be in the developed world.
Yeah, but if you compare the thing that Marjorie's referencing, which I'm sure you know more about than we, if you compare the increase – in longevity
right.
of American women, which, and it is going up some as yeah. compared to the Versus increases in other Western yeah. nations, we're lagging well yeah. behind. I mean, that is frightening.
Yeah. I thought we led the pack.
Well, no, we don't lead the pack. And it just, I think, goes to show we do we have a long way to go. And, you know, the few diseases that we just talked about, you know, we could go on in terms of why these differences. Look at autoimmune disease, far more common in women. Do we really understand why? No. These are things like lupus, MS. I mean, you know, we really have yet to discover what is it that makes them different. Why are they experienced in one sex more than the other?
And I did mention this significant racial gap in breast cancer between mm-hmm. white women and African-American women who are much more likely to die.
Yeah. The you know, I think that you're bringing up a very important point, which was how do we intersect between race, ethnicity, and sex? And it's something that we really do have to focus on, because being a woman, obviously we are biologically women, XXXY, but this whole issue of the influence of race and ethnicity is very important. And racial and ethnic minorities across a number of diseases, whether it be breast cancer, cardiovascular disease, and black women, tend to get the disease earlier, have more severe disease, and die earlier. Now, that requires, once again, a real focus on not only the sex differences between men and women, but we also have to understand how race and ethnicity plays into that. And that's not just, obviously, a biologic fact, and this is true for women as well. We have to understand as well the social context of women and minority women. So, you know, when we talk about sex and gender, sex is who we are biologically, and gender is how we are responded to because of our sex. Both are critically important when we think about women's health and research.
Dr. Johnson, one last question for me. Dr. Johnson is head of the Connors Center for Women's Health and Gender Biology. Our friend Jack Connors dedicating that, I believe, to his mother, correct?
Exactly.
Mary Horgan Connors. When I hear you talk about this research differential and void, if you administered sodium pentothal to one of these researchers and they had to answer honestly, why, and I have no medical background, no scientific background, how can they possibly defend non-equitable numbers? I don't mean as a matter of social fairness, but I mean as a matter of scientific fairness and accuracy. How do they ever explain this deficiency for years and years and years? What's their answer to this?
Well, you're bringing up a very good point, which is that the question isn't frequently asked. And that's, we have got to change the paradigm.
What would they say, though? What possible explanation can there be?
I really think that it's not made necessary, and therefore the question isn't asked.
They probably don't even think about it.
It is not thought about.
Yeah.
And that's our opportunity. It is now going on our 21st year after this 1993 NIH Revitalization Act. We need to celebrate where we've come to, but we really need to examine these gaps and move forward with understanding how we are going to use the tools, the amazing tools of modern medicine and science to advance women's health.
Dr. Johnson, I have one last question for you. Mm-hmm. You're obviously a physician. You're over at teaching at the Harvard Medical mm-hmm. School. What do you think about the pink ribbon campaigns with breast cancer? This is another one of my obsessions. I find it so infantilizing and sort of patronizing. Are you down with the pink ribbons?
I'm not going to make any qualitative statement I'm not going to make a statement about the pink ribbons. This is what I think, though, is around movements, which is that movements are important in terms of raising awareness. They're important in terms of, quite frankly, getting funding. And one thing about breast cancer is that they have been able to focus funding on breast cancer. And it has made a difference. We've seen decreases in rates of death, et cetera. It has made a difference. Here's where I think, though, where we need to do things differently. We have now become siloed into our diseases. And we also haven't necessarily followed the money. In breast cancer, it's predominantly women.
Yeah.
But in other disorders, you know, we have got to really create a much more unified base to call for change and to demand change in the way we do science and how that science is translated into clinical care. Because don't forget, there are things that we know today that are actually not being routinely translated into care. So there's a way in which individual disease movements can be important, We have to make sure we understand when we're investing in those movements that the dollars are actually going where we believe they should go.
Yeah.
And we also need to join forces to create a much more robust platform so that the next 20 years are quite different.
Hey, Dr. Johnson, before you go, we understand you're putting together some huge event in March that's going to address health policy issues. Tell us what it is.
We're having a national Women's Health Policy Summit on March 3rd. It'll be Brigham and Women's Hospital is hosting it. It'll be at the Mandarin Hotel. We're going to have a number of policy leaders. We're having Senators Warren and Gillibrand. Commissioner Peggy Hamburg is going to be there with us. We're going to have representatives from industry and others. And we're going to be presenting a report that we are in the final stages of producing, which will kind of summarize where we've come, but will also recognize the gaps and make some high-level policy recommendations. And we're viewing this event as a kickoff to a major policy agenda to take this NIH Revitalization Act into the future.
Great. Terrific. Look forward to it. Dr. Johnson, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Dr. Paula Johnson is the executive director of the Connors Center for Women's Health at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Thanks for coming in again, Dr. Johnson. When we come back, Peter Kazis joins us for Open Mic. GBH's resident political junkie has something to say about everything, including the HBO series Girls. That conversation up next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Regan here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is the newly anointed senior editor for WGBHnews.org. That would be Peter Kazis. Congratulations and welcome, Peter.
Thanks. It's great to be here. What happened? I thought there was going to be a trumpet flourish or something.
There was, but you were not here for it was before.
No,
that's not what happened. Jim put the kibosh on the trumpet flourish because no one was going to get a trumpet flourish. That's really what happened. So, Peter Kazis, we just talked to Dr. Paula Johnson, who is a professor at Harvard Medical School, big deal at the Brigham Women's Hospital, about buffer zones. The Supreme Court was indicating this morning that they may be inclined to strike down Massachusetts buffer zone law that's been in effect since 2007. What you wanted to say a few words about buffer zones?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things. For this Supreme Court, which I am not generally well disposed of, in this case, in this issue, they have two things that they hold, that the conservative justices hold pretty seriously in conflict. One is the First Amendment, the freedom of speech thing, which I think most people you've covered pretty well. The second is, you know, federalism, regionalism, local response to local situations. And I must say that having read all of Attorney General Coakley's briefs and all of the supporting briefs, that I thought I was going to be on the free speech side, but I, with no reluctance, come over to Martha Coakley's side because the argument is so clear that this was a specific response to a very specific series of circumstances here. Now, interestingly,
maybe those circumstances being murder.
Not just murder.
The harassment and the yelling and the screaming.
People get murdered all the time. People are yelled at and screamed up. No, the specific instance is the police, public authorities were unable to police the situation. Public safety...
Meaning the protesters.
The protesters. And some of the protesters were pro-choice as well as pro-life. Things had so degenerated that it was, a nasty state of affairs. Interestingly enough, the new Boston police commissioner, superintendent, Bill Evans.
Bill Evans, he's the commissioner.
Commissioner is quoted in in the papers before the Supreme Court.
To the difficulty, addressing the difficulty
of policing.
The difficulty
that the police had.
Yep.
And I had a hunch going into this that this that the Massachusetts law was less about free speech and less about a woman's right to choose and more about the state, I mean that literally, the state of Massachusetts and the localities, their ability to police any given situation.
A public safety issue, which theoretically is of local determination is where you're going.
That's a great point, which has been sort of underplayed in a lot of the stories.
Well, because you've got, you know, nothing trumps constitutionality.
Right.
And what the only thing that comes close is, you know, denying women the right to choose. But I think the you're hearing from me at this moment a rare moment of sympathy for at least the conservative justices who see two principles they hold, dearly, really in maybe not in conflict, but certainly not meshing. And the opinion, whatever person in Martha Coakley's office, who wrote this opinion, deserves if there were a Pulitzer Prize for Supreme Court submissions, because what I did...
It's a brilliant strategy, really, because causing that friction for the conservatives.
I put it on the computer and I stripped out all the legal citations, you know, and it reads like a very eloquent and powerful essay.
But wait, let me be clear about this. Are you arguing that from having read the pleadings from both sides, and Coakley in particular here obviously is defending the law, that is her primary concern, or you think that's what the court's going to rest on? Which is it?
No. I'm saying counselor, could you repeat that question?
Yeah. I want to know if you believe what I'm calling this public safety argument, for lack of a better expression, that you just laid out for us. You're saying that's the primary argument of the – or a key argument of the Coakley people, or it's where the Supreme Court is going here.
No. What I'm saying is that is at the root of the act that the Massachusetts legislature passed. That is really the key issue here.
I got it. Okay.
Now, whether the court will grasp that issue, you know, sometimes I say it's A, but the court says, no, A is not important. You know, D is important. I'm just saying that when you strip everything away and go back, look historically at it, this was all motivated by public safety issues. And I have to tell you, I've personally coped with the shift to the radical right in this country is by saying, well, look, there's a lot wrong with Massachusetts, but we have the lowest incidence of death by, you know, gunplay. Women's right to choose is, you know, strongly protected here. On and on and on. And I would find this disturbing, I mean, for many reasons, but if this were overturned, that's sort of one less – there's less safety in Massachusetts from the radical right.
Well, you know, when you say if it's going to be overturned, well, you can never, ever make a safe prediction based on oral argument, even though a lot of the prognosticators are saying the oral argument didn't go well for the Coakley side, the pro-choice side. I think you can suggest that the fact that they took the case at all, when most people thought they were surprised on the right, the left, the pro-choice, the pro-life forces, the fact they even took the case suggests to me that their intention was to strike the buffer zone thing down. And by the way, for those who are listening and saying, oh my God, what does that mean? There's going to be no zone? No, I heard the key plaintiff, that 77-year-old woman from Newton, was saying 9 or 10, I'm paraphrasing, 9 or 10 feet is fine as long as we can hand literature and things to the women.
Yeah. As Javi Civiclite points out in an editorial style opinion piece on WGBHnews.org, he said that even if this buffer zone is struck down, another buffer zone still exists.
Right.
You know, one of the big policing issues, which you didn't have a chance to talk about with Dr. Johnson, but I'll just mention it now, is the taking down of the license plates and the harassment of the workers and the mailing of gruesome, threatening stuff to people that work at Planned Parenthood here and across the country. So that's one of the things. People are afraid.
You know, but Margie, there's nothing illegal about people taking down license plate numbers.
No, but they could be a little bit – they don't have to be shoving their face spaces in the windows of the cars.
This isn't a man. Listen, I agree with you, but this isn't about good manners. You know, look, if why these people persist is beyond me. The fact is, America is still divided over the issue of choice, but this is a pretty motley crew of, you know, rattle brain eccentrics that are actually out in the street.
Mostly men, by the way, which I find interesting because I've lived near these clinics for many years, and it's mostly men. Everybody's always
men
white,
who,
too.
Men who need a shave, and I want to ask,
older.
Why aren't you working to support your families?
Yeah. Well, let's move on to something that's, I don't know if fun is the right word to describe girls, but it's a little bit lighter than this. And there's one particular aspect about girls I really want to talk about. But before I get to that, Peter Kazis, what's with you and girls? You have three sons. Is this because of your going back to your bohemian roots when you lived in New York City, not in Brooklyn, but in Tribeca before it was prohibitively expensive, across the street from the Mud Club, with no heat?
Oh, we're gonna have one of these embarrassing walks down my.
No, we're not. What is it about HBO?
Oh, sure.
Girls?
Let's have an embarrassing walk. Go ahead.
Why do you like
HBO? Well,
actually,
let's
girls?
Hear it first. For those who are not viewers, here is a clip from the season 3 premiere. While Peter decides if he'll take us on that walk that Marjorie was describing. Here it is.
It's the beginning of like a somewhat sexually adventurous time for me. I'm alternating nights of freedom with nights of academic focus so that at the end of my senior year, I will have had both experiences while also being like super well prepared for the professional world.
It sounds like a really good plan. It sounds smart and strong and feminist and...
Mm-hmm. What do you think,
things.
Baby? Good plan, right?
Yeah. No, I think that I think what you think, pretty much.
Good answer. He's learning. Good answer.
Yeah, great scene. They're all around the dinner table. This is sort of people haven't seen it. It's kind of the Brooklyn 20-something full of angst. Sex in the City.
The first season was fascinating. You know, the focus was on, you know, intergender solidarity and intimacy among 20-something post-college, what in the 50s would be called co-eds.
Right.
You know, the second season to me was interesting. Boys, by no stretch of the imagination could these boys be considered even young men. They complicate the solidarity, the sisterly solidarity.
Do.
But it's already beginning to fray. The third season may be showing that the material is being stretched a little bit beyond its ability to be shaped into art as opposed to just commercial TV. It's too soon to say. One of the girls in the office said to me when she found out, somewhat to her amazement, that I was going to be talking about this show, she said, hey, don't forget, you know, everyone, you know, launches into the new season of Girls being kind of disappointed, and you end up thinking it's okay. And that is a good point.
By the way, for those who are ready to send hate mail to Peter Kazis, the new senior editor of WGBHnews.org, he put Girls in the office in quotes when he was saying that a minute ago, but we're not on television, so I wanted to help you out there. Go ahead,
thank
Peter.
Thank you.
I'm here. Go ahead.
You know, in some ways, this show should really be called, you know, The Young and the Well-Connected. I mean, Lena Dunham. Her mom's a big conceptual artist. You know, Marnie is Brian Williams'
kid. Yeah.
Shoshana,
David Mamet. David Mamet, goddammit. Yep. I'm, you know, his daughter.
I didn't know it was David Mamet's daughter.
Yes.
Really?
She's the most annoying character on the whole show. She is.
And
David Mamet could be listening in light of the fact he lives
in
Cambridge.
I assume that's her acting ability.
Okay, fine.
Jess.
Gorgeous.
I don't know. He was the drummer for Bad Company.
I did not know that.
So
you're unbelievable.
But here's my favorite thing. Here's one of my favorite things about Girls is that Lena Dunham is not the perfect body, and you see a lot of her naked body. And I love the fact, and I think a lot of young women talk about this, how great it is to see somebody without their clothes on television who doesn't look like Gisele Bündchen or something like that.
It's
a real woman thing, and it shows that she is attractive to men despite her non-perfection, and I love that.
No, first of all, I like her new hairdo. It's cute.
Yeah, she's cut her hair short.
But I think there's an interesting story here, too. In interviews in the very first season, she said that one reason she joked. She said, well, yeah, I'm an exhibitionist. That's one reason I'm the one who's naked the most. But she said also that there's sort of an unspoken thing on HBO that they want some unspecified degree of female skin.
Yeah.
And Dunham said that since she doesn't mind being naked, that she thought she had, you know, she's sort of taking one for the team, if you will. But see, what's interesting here, though, is that from the idea of the show, I think, is more powerful than the show itself. And that's because she's a real artist.
She's great.
You know, whether you compare her with, she's young, she's still being formed. Well, you know, she has a Woody Allen-like side to her. You know, I think she captures a generation in the same way that Jay McInerney did.
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, I mean, to me, Lena Dunham is more important than the show itself. And the question is, can she balance, you know, her art on the one hand with the commerce of HBO? And I just wonder, listen, you got to think, in this third show, these boys and girls, these men and women are not particularly likable anymore. I mean, I'm losing interest in their lives. I mean, why? Just, you know, who wants to spend
any time
with
them? Can I tell
you
the joy that I'm having standing back here? I'm listening to Peter Kadzis, former executive editor, whatever you were called, at the Boston Phoenix, ran the Boston Phoenix, one of the great papers of all time forever. Now the senior editor, as of this week, at WGBHnews.org, waxing poetic about girls. So are you going to be the television critic at WGBHnews.org as well, Peter Kadzis?
No, I think Jared Bowen would have my knees broken before I left the studio.
Jared Bowen.
But you know what I think about this?
It's pop culture. I did pop culture, and it's...
But what I think is great about girls, even though you're right about they're not being that likable, it is a totally different, and especially if you have daughters that are in their late teen years,
it made
early
me very
years,
happy. I have all boys.
Yeah, it captures a reality of their professional pressures, of their sex life, which is really something.
Margie, I've talked to your daughter.
Yes,
about
I have two daughters that are very into it. One of them lives in Brooklyn. I hope she's not carrying on the way these people are on this TV show.
I won't tell you about those conversations. You don't have anything to worry about.
But they find it very accurate. That's my point.
I'll tell you. I can't attest to its accuracy, but I'll tell you, back, you know, when Ronald Reagan was elected president,
yes,
and I was living in the loft, as you said, New York, with no heat, across from the Mud Club. My mother, the one and only time she visited, she walked in, she looked around the loft, and she said very sweetly, "Peter, you always acted like you lived in the barn. Now you do." But
well,
I'll tell you, I don't find the girls wildly different. There are some big differences. The real tension between being a woman and a career was not as pronounced as I remembered. I was in my 20s and I was following my career, and next to following my career, my other big pursuit was chasing girls. But
you weren't going down that path. Isn't that what
but
you
here's
said?
Here's the thing, too. I mean, it gets criticized because it's very, you know, it's very white bread. They're all white women. They're all
I have
white
no
women
problem with that.
Privilege.
It's about white
it's,
girls.
It's capturing a certain segment of, well, a lot of people complain that, you know, look at these girls. They don't have any problems. Their parents bail them out.
They don't have any problems. I mean, my God, they're all on the verge of committing suicide.
Well, Lena Dunham, one of them just got out of rehab over the weekend, and Lena Dunham basically had a total breakdown on last season's show, and she had ticks and she had OCD problems. So, you know, I mean, it's real life, and I find it kind of fascinating. I feel voyeuristic watching it. And like I said, hoping my daughters aren't doing what they're doing.
Okay, so we have one popular cultural critic speaking glowingly of girls. That would be Peter Kadzis. On
with
the
some
line
reservations.
Well, okay, fine, Peter. I'll characterize your position. Thank you very much. Now, our other television critic is on the line who is not of the same opinion. Her name would be Callie Crossley. Callie, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, could you
tell
rip Peter Kadzis to shreds, please? Can you? Go ahead, Callie.
I detest that show, that smug, self-satisfied little show that pretends like the whole world exists only in their little white bread, you know, scenario. And it's okay to do that and acknowledge it, but they never do. That's my thing. Well, so, you know, and it just takes me to the hoop every time. I can't even. And the fact that she's getting praised for this, like this is some great revelation that she's navel-gazing, it just makes me insane.
So wait a minute, wait a minute.
By the way, I don't disagree with Callie, except that it is just as Seinfeld was a show about nothing. This is a show about rich, privileged, screwed up white girls.
And I think they should acknowledge that.
How
do they
acknowledge it?
Shut up about it. But
what do they do?
The fact that they ape, you know, hipsterism, and it just makes me insane. You know, I'd actually have more respect for her to say, you know what, we are living our little, and we know this is a narrow little life. You know, if you can write about all the rest of the crap that they put in that show, then write about that as a real, you know, something to say about what's happening with our society. Because after all, the thing that distresses me, this was the generation that wasn't supposed to have this as part of their life. They went to school with everybody. They went to go to work with everybody. We're supposed to see something different from them. So wouldn't it be really something, really, really show me something, if she actually wrote about, hey, that was supposed to happen. It didn't. Wonder why it doesn't.
Wait a minute. What are you talking about? That they should say that we're sorry we don't have any African-American women
on
here?
No, we're sorry, but just acknowledge that that's how they live. And this is the reality of, you know, part of our the problem with our racial discourse in this country is that after this generation, which, as I said, went to school with, works with, these were the people that were supposed to come away not having the same kind of hang-ups that other people did who were when we were very much more segregated in our other lives. That's not to say that there is not segregation going on in housing, which I believe is part and parcel of all of this. But I'm saying, wouldn't that be a deeper kind of discourse to talk about all the kind of crap she's talking about, but also to acknowledge that in the writing and the acting of that show?
I think she's been asked about it many times, though, right? I understand what Callie's saying.
Yeah, Callie, what this show may well be is a testimony to the failure of that system that brought this generation of people up.
And so I think that, that to me would have been some really interesting writing and acting around some scenarios in which she could have put into that really demonstrate that. Because, you know, if that's the life you're leading, that's the life you're leading. I'm not saying it's not. And I know a lot of people who lead those kinds of lives. But there is conversation around you. There is context around you. And it would have been interesting. So to me, that would have, you know, she's being touted as being some kind of brilliant soothsayer of her generation. Really? You know?
Hey, Callie, I just saw in the Associated Press, she's just announced that next week Kenan Thompson in drag is going to be on the show. Hey, Callie Crossley, thanks so much for calling in. So there's a little bit of a disagreement about Girls Season 3. Hey, Peter, since your area of expertise, at least to me, prior to hearing this thing about girls, is politics. Two levels I want to talk to you about briefly. Marty Walsh has been in office. How many days now? What is this, 15th? 9 days and counting for Marty Walsh. Give us your take on the first 9 days of the first new mayor in 20 years.
Okay, if I was scoring, I'm scoring it now.
Mm-hmm.
I would say safe and successful. I would give him about a 7.5 or an 8. I mean, I'm not being snarky when I say this. I mean, he hasn't done anything yet.
I don't agree.
He's made the point. Well, I'll tell you where I think a
lot of what one does when one immediately takes office is about symbolism. And I think symbolism matters. And when you take an issue,
I mentioned
this, we were talking to Kelly Bates about this yesterday and Bob Hedlund. When you decide to focus not once, but pretty relentlessly in your first week in office on urban violence, particularly urban violence in a limited number of communities in the city you were just elected to run, when you know, sadly, that a majority of people in your city probably don't have that atop your agenda, I think that's a pretty powerful statement from a guy when most newly elected people play it pretty safe. That's not a safe choice. That seems to me to be a pretty heartfelt choice. Would you not agree?
I would agree with that. It's also very good politics. Those things aren't in that the people who elected him, the swing in the coalition, if you will, are the so-called communities of color. I think that's good. But that's a symbol. I mean, that's on the surface. And I'm developing this idea that it is still very rough in my idea in my mind. So I might.
What is the what is
the idea? Is that Marty Walsh's election marks a transition in the nature of Boston politics, in that what we're seeing is something that's been building up nationally for a long time. But Marty Walsh is an exemplar of what I call the politics of the therapeutic.
What does that mean?
Well, what that means is first harken back to Oprah. Oprah is an incredibly powerful social symbol. Oprah is an African-American woman who became a multimillionaire by selling the idea that we can, engage openly via media with ourselves, and she became rich doing it. That's one reason why she's not only smart, but she has the dollars to back it up. What's happened is there's a sociologist, Philip Reeve, who in 1966 published a book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic. And he said that at that time, as Christianity and religion loses its power, and I'm summarizing here, the sort of watered down theories of Sigmund Freud are going to come in and fill the gap. I think you can see some of this. Now, I don't mean just the surface of Marty Walsh acknowledging that he's a recovering alcoholic, because that too was good politics. And life has moved on. People make mistakes, they bounce back, and it's really good that that can happen. But take a look at there's something very therapeutic, touchy-feely about his very successful political outreach to, thousands of people, his attempt to sort of make instant Menino light with his mass meetings, with his mass inauguration.
Do you buy it as heartfelt, or do you think it's strategic? I mean, my sense is this is who this guy is.
No, it's a little bit heartfelt. And a little bit strategic.
He feels their pain.
No, more than anything. No, more than anything. It's subconscious. This is just who
he is.
Who we are. That it's who we are. He's responding to a massive change in the electorate. That's what I'm saying. I'm not sure.
People want to be acknowledged and validated. To use the
therapeutic
phrase.
In other words, Marty is 20% authentic about this, 20% conniving or calculating. The 60% in the center is subconscious. It's not just who he is. It's who everyone else is. Look at Ariana Presley. Ayanna Presley. Her rhetoric is much more Oprah-like than Marty Walsh.
She's the top vote getter on the city council. She ran for president, lost to Bill Linehan last week.
Yeah. Women love her. Yeah. Reporters don't.
Well, she should. If she returned phone calls, it might be.
Exactly.
Well, that's part of it, yeah.
But what I'm saying is there's a change. There's a change taking place. And by the way, this change is taking place all across America. It's just that we happen to be here in Boston and, we can shine a little light on it. I'm not sure exactly where it's going, but I'm convinced I'm onto something.
Well, one of my theories about Marty Walsh, if you've been doing the 12 steps and you've been going to AA meetings for 18 years and you've been reciting that serenity prayer and you've been making amends every place you go, that has to have an effect on you after all these years.
It does, but I'm not narrowing it down to his wrestling, with his demons is. There's a whole change in society. It's like, well, if we talk about it enough, that'll be good. It's not, frankly, I'm of the old-fashioned school. We have housing needs. I don't want to have a public love in about housing. I want to know how we're going to build 10,000 more units.
But we only
housing.
Have 30 seconds left, but and literally 30 seconds. Wouldn't you say that earlier practitioners of this on a larger scale were two of the great politicians of our time, Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, who really conveyed to people, Marjorie used the expression, I feel your pain, but it conveyed the notion that they knew what your life was like.
They are part of that shift that I'm talking about. And it's come home to roost in Boston.
Peter Kadzis, it's a pleasure.
Used to live in the barn in Tribeca as a senior editor of WGBHnews.org. When we come back, we're going to be joined by writer Joyce Maynard, who talks to us about her book, Labor Day, and the story behind adapting it to the big screen with Kate Winslet and Josh Brolin. That conversation next, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. It's probably fair to say that everyone who's heard of Joyce Maynard knows that we're having a nine-month affair with writer J.D. Salinger, but it's probably also fair to say that anyone who has read Joyce Maynard has a good sense of who she is. Joyce Maynard wrote her first memoir looking back when she was 19. 25 years later, she wrote her second, At Home in the World. In between and beyond, she's written several novels. Her latest one is entitled After Her. But today we're talking about her 2009 book. It's called Labor Day. Director Jason Reitman has adapted it to the big screen.
Who are police looking for? Frank Chambers, an inmate at Finchfield Prison serving 18 years for murder.
I'd be grateful if you let me stay till nightfall.
Isn't it against the law to hide a fugitive?
If someone were to come by, it would need to look like I kidnapped you.
How do I know you won't hurt us? I'm stronger than you think.
I've never intentionally hurt anyone in my life.
What happened?
Just know that there's more to this story than you'll see in that paper there. You won't be needing that any longer. When you have to say I tied you up, you won't be lying.
Labor Day, the movie, opens nationwide on January 31st. The film was shot locally in Massachusetts, primarily in Shelburne Falls and Acton. It stars Josh Brolin, Tobey Maguire, and Kate Winslet. In fact, Joyce is calling this the Kate Winslet is unavailable tour. We're actually quite glad she is, because we're thrilled to meet you, Joyce Maynard. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Who thought, who would have thought that she'd get her big glamour moment a month after her 60th birthday?
Exactly.
Hers being yours, we're
Mine.
Talking about.
Wonderful.
Yes, happy birthday.
I've been walking
it's,
the red carpet this
it's
year.
It's wonderful. And
I like to feel I'm an inspiration to, I'll call us midlife women.
You
everywhere.
Are. You are. As I said before we went on the air, I'm a big groupie. I've been a Joyce Maynard fan for years and years and years. And the clip from the movie sounds very sexy.
By the way, let me just say,
this movie has the sexiest pie
Josh,
scene ever.
I want to talk about that, and I just want to say before we start, I am not a 60-year-old woman, and I am a big fan of yours. So let's get that on the record.
When this movie was previewed at the Telluride Film Festival, Jim, I ran into Michael Moore, who I know slightly, and he said, "You wouldn't believe the men's room in there. They're all sniffling after seeing the movie."
Well, I mean,
I love to make the men cry.
Josh Brolin is a fine specimen of an actor. He's a very handsome guy. Escape Con
and fine baker. That is a little known fact about
him. Well, you taught him how to bake a pie, correct? But before we get to the pie, tell us basically, what is Labor Day? What's the movie? Tell us about it.
The story, Labor Day tells the story of a love affair that ensues, that takes place over the course of a long, hot Labor Day weekend. Ooh. In a small New Hampshire town, as seen through the eyes of the 13-year-old son of the woman who's fallen in love. And the man she falls in love with is a convict on the run who gets her to take him home. And they're holed up in this house over this steamy weekend. And we see their love affair through the boy's eyes. And also 25 years later, after he's looking back on this weekend that had cataclysmic implications for all
of us. I've read you, Joyce, say you love the film. And how intimately involved were you in the script, in picking the players? And
officially, there's no involvement. And you know what? The last thing a director wants is to have the writer standing over his or her shoulder saying, well, I think this should change. You have to be prepared to let your work go.
But aren't you in agony waiting to see what the...
Of course, of course. And Jason Reitman, although he had no requirement to do this, was constantly showing me, checking in with me. I read the screenplay and I loved he adapted the novel, and it's a very true adaptation to the spirit of the book. Of course, people should still read the book. We all know that the book is the best thing.
Well, there's something particular about the book that if people want to read it in the audio fashion or hear it in the audio fashion. Tell us about what's going on with the book when you hear it.
When you hear the book, I don't know. You have
your
to tell
son
me your son.
Reads
oh, my son,
it.
The audiobook. Oh.
We don't need Joyce for this interview. We can answer the questions.
The audiobook of Labor Day.
is read by your
is,
son.
Is read by my
An
son,
actor.
Wilson Bethel,
yes.
who's on a show called Heart of Dixie.
Okay.
On Heart of Dixie, he has an Alabama accent, but he's a New Hampshire boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to brush off this agony thing. You had an earlier book, To Die For, also made into a movie.
Yeah.
What is that when you first get the script from the director And you get to see for the first time what they have done to what you labored over.
You know, I've
What's that like?
This is untypical, I have to say, Jim, but I've been lucky twice. Buck Henry adapted To Die For. And so twice I've really had a wonderful film made of my novel. And
Pamela Smart.
I like to think it's because I write really good stories.
You do.
And they're stories that are very, I think they're, you know, there's a lot that happens in them. It's always about character for me. And these are really interesting, complex characters. But big things happen. So, yes, I'm twice happy. I've written 8 novels, and only 2 have been made for films, but my life's not over yet.
Well, if people forget the dreaded local angle, To Die For is based on the Pamela Smart murder trial, and Pamela Smart, of course, was not supposed to call her a teacher because she was some kind of audiovisual specialist or something
right.
like that.
You were there every day, were you not?
She had an aspiration to be you, basically.
That's right. And she paid her 15-year-old boyfriend to shoot her husband in the head.
Well, she paid him in an unusual fashion.
She did.
Or maybe a classic fashion.
They had a torrid affair.
Yes.
And who played Pamela Smart in the movie?
Nicole Kidman.
It was great.
In what I consider still her best role.
It was very funny.
I played her lawyer. You might not know that. I'm in that movie, as I am in Labor Day. But really, I was a little disappointed with my cameo. My real appearance in Labor Day is in the form of the pie, which is totally my pie.
Okay, you've mentioned the pie 3 times now, so let's get to it. Everybody is talking about the fact that you taught Josh Brolin how to do the pie thing, and now we know that after you taught him, he made a pie every single day during production to the point where there was a peach shortage in Concord, Mass. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but I do know that people were actually pushing the pies away. And he makes a fine pie, but it's almost too good, you know?
So what's with you and pies?
You know, my pie story starts 25 years ago. Well, it starts 60 years ago when I was born. I am the daughter of a spectacular pie maker. And I never needed to make pie because my mother always made pie. And then my mother was dying of cancer. And I went to take care of her. And I made pie every day of that summer for her and her friends. And I didn't know I knew how to make her pie, but I had breathed it in. And her friends would take me aside and say, we're going to miss your mother, but we're going to miss her pie. Would you give us the recipe? And I said to them what I have been saying for the 25 years since. It's not about the recipe. The recipe is always the same. It's about how you handle the dough, how you make that. We're speaking of crust here, of course, the big issue for people.
It's really hard.
And the only way to learn is at the elbow of somebody who knows how to do it. So I have probably taught at this point a few thousand people how to make pie. I only do it for love. I do it if there's some candidate I believe in or an earthquake's happened in Haiti. I open up my doors and charge a little money and teach people how to make pie. So when I was writing Labor Day, and I was thinking about this character of Frank, the escaped convict, who you know, could seem like a really bad guy, and we want to see who he truly is, a neighbor shows up that weekend and gives Adele, the mother, who's now Kate Winslet in my mind, a bucket of overripe peaches, and she's about to throw them out. And Frank, the convict, now Josh Brolin, says, "Wait a second. I'll tell you. I have a better idea." And he proceeds to make a pie. So Josh
and
had
to teach them, right?
And teach
Winslet
them.
And the
so,
kid.
So he had to have not just make a pie. He had to have command of that pie. And he had to be to really get the sense of just he owned that pie. And he did. He did. His pie does not look like a Martha Stewart. It was actually kind of funny, Marjorie and Jim, but I feel like, you know, we have this pie.
We bonded.
Yes. They had on set this high-level, famous movie food person who was wearing her white chef coat, which is not me. And she was looking a little appalled at my methods. I don't measure. I scoop the Crisco with one hand and the sugar with the other. And I'm flour is flying, dough is flying, and apple peels are going over my shoulder. I was much influenced by things that happened in the WGBH studio years ago.
Is that so?
Yes.
Oh. What happened in the WGBH
studio? Well, the Julia Child method.
Oh, Julia Child. Okay, all right.
Can you do a Julia Child imitation? I bet you can, Joyce.
My son can be anybody. My son. You know, this is actually, well, it's not getting off track because really at the core of this story is a question that was always much on my mind. What is it like for your children to watch you conducting a love affair with somebody who isn't their parent? If you're a single
I know.
Parent. And my children did grow up with that sometimes. I was a single parent for most of their growing up years. And my son Will, this came to me because my son Will, the one who's the actor, is terrifyingly good at doing imitations. He could be Julia Child. And one day he called me up, and he was about 10 years old, and he was at his dad's house, and he called me up and he said in a voice that was unrecognizable, "So, what are you wearing?"
Wait a minute. This was when you were at home? Were
I was at
Paramore?
Home. I could have been wearing something that I wouldn't have wanted him to know. But I knew that I didn't know anybody who would be asking that question, unfortunately. And then I knew Will, so that I did realize, oh my gosh, that is my son, just in time.
That's the voice of Joyce Mayer,
but in
by
fact,
the way.
That is an element of Labor Day. We are seeing a young boy just entering his own sexuality, observing in a discomforting way the sexuality of his mother, but also yearning for a father in his life.
So how autobiographical is Del?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I was a single parent, a single mother in a small New Hampshire town. I even drove the car that Kate, I never told Jason this, but that was, he gave Kate Winslet the car I used to drive, an enormous boat of a Ford Country Squire wagon with wood paneling. But I'm not that agoraphobic woman who just, you know, can barely go out.
Yeah.
And she does go out. The way she meets the convict is that her son has outgrown his pants, and it's back to school coming up after Labor Day weekend. So she takes him shopping for new school pants, and it is at the Price Mart store that this man comes staggering up with blood, you know, coming down his head and says, "Would you take me home?" And she does.
Well, you know, lots of us might be tempted if we saw Josh Brolin in the parking lot to say, throw my caution to the wind with the blood coming down, because he is one very handsome man. What was it like to be up close and personal with two people that Josh Brolin and whose mother-in-law is Barbara Streisand?
Yes. Actually, years ago, Barbara Streisand was going to play me in a movie, which was something he didn't know, because I think that was before his dad's time. I was an anti-nuclear organizer in New Hampshire in the 80s, and Barbara Streisand read a story that I'd written about campaigning against the first in the nation high-level nuclear waste dump coming to New Hampshire, and she bought the rights to my story. Never played me, unfortunately. She never played a New Hampshire housewife.
Are they close? Do you have any idea?
I don't really know. We did.
He is married to Diane Lane. We know that.
I've had a certain experience in my own life of being endlessly identified with some famous person while I've been conducting my own life and doing my own things. And so I don't fault you, Jim, but it's happened every day of the last 41 years. So the last person I would ever ask Josh Brolin about would be Barbara Streisand.
Well, speaking of that, have you ever done an interview? Thank you for not folding me.
No, I never.
I mean, you just wrote about this a couple of months ago yourself when the documentary came out, the Salinger documentary. Done an interview where Salinger's name has not arisen?
Well,
never.
You know, but you wrote a great, brilliant piece in the New York Times after the documentary about Salinger came out. And I think that everybody, particularly women, can identify this, where you had this line in there that said, it is the quiet, and of course, if people don't know this, Salinger was picking up, for lack of a better word, very young women to carry on with. And you were 18, as you put out in your story.
I was hardly the only one.
One of them was 14, and there were at least a dozen of these women. It's really kind of creepy, in my view anyway. And you write about the quiet acceptance, apparently alive and well in our culture, of the notion that genius justifies cruel or abusive treatment of those who serve the artist, Salinger, and his art. And you quote this film critic as saying, "He liked pretty girls." The implication being, what's the fuss?
Yes.
He did get a free pass for much of his life and even post his life on being a guy 50, 60, 70 years old going after very, very young women.
Well, yes. The part that personally has been wounding to me is that, and I'm over it, it's okay, but that for so many years I was identified in one way as, you know, the ex-girlfriend of the important man. And meanwhile, I've written 13 books, actually quite a few more than he ever did.
More than he has, that's right.
So for me, that this film, which has absolutely no relationship to Salinger, is a wonderful film, and it's hardly the only thing I've done in the last 41 years, is the best way that I know to counter
it. Why do you say no relationship to Salinger?
Because there's only one book of the 13 in which I address
mentioned
what that story meant, and that is At Home in the World, a book that I always say, if people want to know what happened and if people take issue with me, I will ask them, have you read that book?
And you were 19 when you wrote that book.
No, we're not speaking of that book. We're speaking of the book I wrote 25 years later.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For 25 years, I said nothing of him. I subscribe to this belief that many people still do, that, you know, you do not speak of the great man because he said not to do that. And then I wrote the real memoir, the one that is the story of my life, not the story of Salinger, the story of me, but he's in it. It was almost universally condemned. Time magazine said the one good thing about this book is we'll never have to hear from Joyce Maynard again. Hello.
So when you see, the Golden Globes on Sunday night?
I did not see them because I was at a screening of
Did you hear about Diane Keaton's acceptance of the Cecil B. She accepts the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Award for Woody Allen.
Yes.
And in her speech, if this is not a fair characterization, Marjorie, tell me, but she opens talking about the brilliant job he has done with women's roles. And the sense I got as a viewer is that she was basically saying, I know you're all thinking about Sun Yi. Because you really haven't given Woody Allen the same pass she didn't have it that you're suggesting Salinger may have gotten. And I found that, and I'm a huge fan of hers, and sad to say I'm actually a huge fan of his, at least his work, as opposed to his humanity.
We can be fans of a person's work.
But do you have a problem? I mean, that's what I was going to ask you separately. I mean, we often talk about – Marjorie said just yesterday, I don't know who we were speaking with. Who did you say to that we're supposed to hate Alec Baldwin now because what a horrible person he is, but he's a really talented kind of guy. Where is the divide with you?
To me – It doesn't.
Your work is your work.
Your work is your work, and it should no more be required. I mean, do I base my purchase of a car on the personality of the CEO? Mm-hmm. Probably. I mean, if he didn't treat his workers right, I guess forget that metaphor. That one didn't work. There's my work and there's my life, and I would like to think that my work could be looked at just totally separate from my life. It never has been. And his, he laid down the law very early on that we were not to know about his life.
Do you think it's any different now, 2013, that attitude about the genius male artist, whatever he does in his private life, even if it's really kind of... creepy is
okay. or she
that's
yes.
true. I mean, it's or are we a little bit more critical of those kinds of things?
I'm the mother of three adult children who are now 29, 31, and 35, and I see a kind of open-mindedness in them that did not exist in my generation, certainly. I mean, they don't subscribe to all these sort of old ideas. It's very refreshing, actually.
You know, Joyce Maynard, when we were talking about you upstairs before we came down, Marjorie said two things. One, she first said how much she has admired your work forever. We talked about that a little bit. And then her
it was looking back. You wrote when you were 19. I'm sorry about that. Not alone.
That you appeared, was it last year, on what do you call the
the
weddings page?
The women's sports page.
Oh, yes.
The women's sports
page.
In the New York Times. Yes, that's right. Because I the women's sports page.
I always read that page before I was on it.
They're great.
Yeah.
It's a style section of the Sunday New York Times. I read it now with my oldest daughter. We much enjoy it. And I turn, and whose is the featured wedding but Joyce Maynard's, who met your husband on Match.com.
I did.
Which I thought was so courageous for
someone
who's famous.
I met a lot of other people on Match.com that I didn't marry, I'll say.
But I mean, because you're a famous person. You were quite out there. It would be like some TV star or something putting themselves on Match.com.
This actually connects with that other idea. I mean, are people who write books or, you know, make movies, are they sort of exempt from all the normal human experiences? Do we sort of feel like, they wouldn't do something like want to fall in love? Well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, I've been knocking around as a single person. I had been for 25 years. I married very young and had three children, and I was divorced in 1989. That's a lot of years. So to get married on the eve of one's 60th birthday to somebody else who had been divorced for 25 years, I thought that was a real cause for celebration, and I wanted to announce it to the world. This is possible because there are a lot of women and men out there who have that same dream and sometimes feel it's impossible. Actually, it's not unconnected with Labor Day. That woman is a woman who's sort of given up hope. And then this extraordinary relationship comes from the least likely direction. And
I don't think it's a fairy tale, but it's definitely an optimistic, you know, it's a story that we want to believe. And for 2 hours, when you go to Labor Day, I think Jason Reitman has done a pretty good job of making us imagine how that could happen.
And by the way, I should say the commercials, which ran incessantly during the Golden Globes the other night, are fabulous. I don't know if you didn't see the Golden Globes. So before you go, Joyce Maynard, well, first of all, this new husband of yours, was he drawn at all to the pie baking skills, or was that just
that was
an ancillary deal?
An unexpected fringe benefit. He knew nothing of my work, my pies, no.
Okay, so this is an audio medium, unfortunately. Give us, before you go, give people who probably are wildly interested in the pie thing, give us a couple of tips for the novice pie baker.
Well, I will tell those people, since we are limited by audio, that I have actually, because this comes up a lot, I have made an online video that they can see.
Ah, fantastic.
And it's on Curious.com, okay. A wonderful platform. If they're new to Curious, they won't even have to pay anything. It's normally like 99 cents. It's like an iTunes download. And it is a pie lesson that will filmed in my kitchen, and by the time you're done with that lesson, you too will make a great pie. But for those who don't own a laptop, perhaps.
Or can't wait.
Can't wait. I will say there needs to be less water than you think. Most pies, including the sort of those beautiful Martha Stewart pies, are too smooth, too perfect. My pie looks like it was made by a convict on the run. It is that flaky. And you need to just barely, my mother always said, never overhandle the dough. You just touch it the least you can. Butter is better for flavor. Crisco is better for flakiness. So, of course, I use both. I measure nothing, but I technically the recipe is what all the recipes are. But I would say joie de vivre. You cannot over-worry your pie crust. You have to do it with a certain freedom and an attitude that, you know, a forgiving attitude.
Look at the look on Marjorie's face, Joyce Maynard, as you were describing this.
I don't know how to make pies.
You are 15 minutes away from knowing.
Okay. I think that's true.
Yes.
Okay, and if people want to know about your work, what you're doing, where they can hear you do readings.
I have a website.
What is your website? You teach writing as well.
Yes, I do. I'm heading off to Guatemala.
Guatemala.
Once a year, I go to a little Mayan village on the shores of Lake Atitlan, looking out over the volcanoes, and help people tell the story of their life, because I paid a big price for telling the story of mine, and I would never, never undo that. So I love to facilitate other people of all levels. But JoyceMaynard.com, just
my
name.
That's very easy. We can all remember that.
Joyce, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
And, you know, I mentioned this when you first came in, but it's a great collection of columns, which is in a book, which you can probably still get on Amazon.
You can download
Amazon.com, yeah. Domestic Affairs, about just being a mom with kids, the married life when your kids are little. It was a great...
Do you know, I have to tell you, just
what?
As a historical
what?
Fact, I wrote that column for 8 years, but 7 years into that column, my marriage ended. And of course, what could I do? I had to say that happened. Of the 50 papers that ran that column, 40 dropped it and said, this was not ancient history. This is 1989. And they said I was no longer equipped to write about family life. And in some ways, you know, I'm bringing this all back to Labor Day. I wanted to honor the family life of a single parent, that too is family life. That too is a family.
Thank you very much, Joyce Maynard. A pleasure to meet you. And people who haven't read Joyce should get her books, JoyceMaynard.com, and go to the movie Labor Day. It's opening January 31st.
Men will like it too.
Okay. I'm there.
Well, we all like looking at Josh Brolin, don't we? Even other guys. Kate Winslet's not bad either. Joyce Maynard, thank you so much for being
pleasure.
With us.
And men like baking too. Now, Marjorie is clearly going to bake a pie tonight. That's clear. If you go to WGBHnews.org, we have a video of Joyce Maynard making one of her legendary pies. You can learn too, you can watch, and then you can bake. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we talk to Harvard University Professor Lawrence Lessig. You may know that Professor Lessig is walking across New Hampshire in memory of Aaron Swartz. Remember Aaron Swartz, the internet activist, political activist who took his own life, facing federal prosecution and potentially decades in jail. Professor Lessig will join us from the road live tomorrow. That plus open mic with Alex Bean. Kara Miller from the Innovation Hub will be here as well. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team includes Will, Amanda, John, and Chelsea and me. And you can follow us before tomorrow if you really have the compulsion, and why not? Me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan, and the show at BOS Public Radio. That's BOS Public Radio. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow at noon.